From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Like so many children of mixed marriages, the author Heidi Durrow has often felt like she's had to straddle two worlds. She's the daughter of a black serviceman and a white Danish mother. Her own personal search for identity inspired her debut novel. It's called The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. The story revolves around a girl who moves across country to live with her grandmother after surviving a family tragedy. That preteen, Rachel, is also the daughter of a black GI and a white Danish mother. And as the story unfolds, you discover just how unfathomable her family tragedy was. Her mother, brother, and baby sister all died after leaping off a Chicago apartment building, a jaw-dropping turn of events that was actually based on a real story. And Heidi Durrow joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
What was that event that inspired the tragedy in the book, the mother leaping off a building with her small children?
It was a real newspaper story that I read about 15 years ago. A mother went to the top of the building, and the only survivor of this fall was this girl. I remember reading that and just being haunted by not the questions that the other people were asking about why this happened and how could we live in a world where this would happen, but I wondered what would her survival look like?
And what the girl's survival would look like.
Yes, yes. I wanted to give her a future. I was hoping her life wouldn't be defined by a tragedy. And I really wanted to give her a voice to see how she might grow up.
How difficult was it as a writer to write about a little girl named Rachel whose life sounds a lot like yours, but also write about this mother and this cauldron of emotions that she must have been feeling that would lead her to walk her children up to the top of a building and then leap to certain death below?
It was difficult in that what I learned when I was writing the book itself is that I missed my mother when I was growing up in a way that I didn't understand until really the last year or two. My mom, like Nella, raised three kids on her own suddenly when we moved to Portland, Oregon. And she was busy working, providing for us, making sure that we would be okay. And I don't think she knew about the struggles I was having with biracial identity and living in this new place where I had to, like Rachel, identify myself in a new way that I wasn't aware of. And I, as a kid, didn't have a language for her to talk about it. And I realized as I was writing this story that maybe one of the reasons I was so haunted by this event, this newspaper story of a mother who goes to the top of the building and thinks this is the best way, is just that I'm glad my mom didn't think those things. I'm glad that she actually gave us a chance to go through all the struggles that we did.
Nella is the mother. I'm wondering, is that a nod to Nella Larsen, the Harlem Renaissance writer?
It is. She's hugely important for me. And she's half black and half Danish. And she's my muse in many ways. I wish that she could hear this story now and see if she finds herself in my story all these many years later when she was writing about this back in the 1920s and early 30s.
She's the author of the books Quicksand and Passing.
Yeah. In college, I was really enamored with the African-American women writers that I was reading. And I read The Bluest Eye, and I thought, oh my goodness, Toni Morrison gets me. She understands me because of Pecola Breedlove. And I don't think it was until much later, I would say in my late 20s, that I read it again and I realized, oh my God, Pecola Breedlove isn't me. You know, she was the little black girl who desperately wanted blue eyes, and that's what led to all sorts of devastation for her. And I'm the little brown girl who has blue eyes and is trying to make sense of the world.
Heidi, in the book, Rachel often feels like she has to choose, you know, either move toward one culture or hold on to her Danishness. Why does she have to choose? Why do children of mixed race marriages have to make that kind of choice? Why can't they embrace both cultures?
Well, I think they can if they're not faced with this question, what are you? The satisfactory answer usually isn't, I'm black and white. Other people want mixed race kids to choose who they are. You know, I started this book in 1997. It's taken that long to write it and to get it published. And the language has changed, definitely, about biracial identity. Obviously, when President Obama began his candidacy and we started to talk about biracial, it suddenly didn't sound like a scientific term. Still, though, now, I think people are uneasy with that. And I think we can see that in the fact that once there was the inauguration, President Obama became our first African-American president, which I believe he is. But we stopped talking about biracial again. I think it's a little unsettling for people for just trying to understand what does it mean to be both black and white.
Heidi, as you well know, there's a long line of stories, books, movies, songs, folklore about the tragic mulatto trope. Why does this continue? And do you in any way feel like you were pulled into that undertow?
I hope I wasn't. I hope that people can read this book as a break from that tradition. I think that tragedies generally end with a tragedy and there's nothing learned. And my book begins with the tragedy. And at the end, I hope that people have learned something, that there's a note of triumph in that. I wanted, especially in this story, to say, yes, something really bad has happened to this girl. Yes, it's really difficult for her to deal with her mixed race background in the world as it exists, but the tragedy is outside of her. It's not something that's part of her character. I think that's the thing that's been frustrating about other stories about the tragic mulatto, that somehow it was an inherent difficulty within the character. For Rachel, it's definitely not true that the difficulties come from without and that she has this center, this core, this heart that really is, she's still able to be whole ultimately and I think ultimately triumphant.
One last quick question for you. Are you okay with the term biracial or is there something else that you would like to hear as a label or a description applied to you?
I like biracial. I say I'm mixed. I say I'm half African-American and half Danish. If I have to say that I'm just black or I'm just white, then I'm not telling the whole story of myself or my experience. And I'd really like to be whole in my conversations with others. The thing I like to say these days is I'm a story. I think that would be the very best label of all, definitely.
Heidi Durow, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Heidi Durow is the author of The Girl Who Fell from the Sky.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Barack Obama begins the end game today of the health care debate. He will outline a way forward for Congress. NPR's Mara Liasson is here to explain the latest White House plans to heave health care legislation over the finish line. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
So he is not scrapping the bill and starting over, as Republicans have demanded and did demand at the healthcare summit this last week. What is the president's plan?
Well, the way forward involves this complicated set of votes where the House will have to accept the bill passed by the Senate on Christmas Eve. Then both houses will pass a package of fixes that represent the compromise between that Senate bill and the one the House passed back in November. And it's this package of changes that the Senate is going to try to pass by a simple majority vote using that procedure known as reconciliation that we've been hearing so much about.
Pretty complex sounding to an outsider. But does this mean that the 7.5-hour summit last week was just a show, or is the president serious about what he said yesterday, which is bringing in some Republican ideas?
Well, today at the White House, the president is going to say that he wants to incorporate 4 Republican ideas that came up at Blair House about waste, fraud, and abuse, tort reform, doctor reimbursement, and health savings accounts. But he is clearly sticking with his plan to do comprehensive reform, and he will say today that he believes piecemeal reform is not the best way to go.
And Mara, what makes the administration think this can get through Congress, given that Democrats have fewer votes than they did when the House and Senate passed their bills last year?
Well, it's going to be a very heavy lift. In the Senate, Harry Reid has to get 51 votes for this package of fixes under reconciliation. It looks like he will probably be able to get those. But in the House, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, has a very small pool of no votes to convert to yes, and some of her previous yes votes, the votes that voted yes in November, have been wavering because people are panicking. Democrats are panicking about November. The president is going to have to work very hard to twist arms and convince Democrats that doing nothing is worse for them politically, because they'll look like they can't govern, than passing something controversial.
And of course, the healthcare is big business, as we all now know, and lobbyists are surely are gearing up for a huge last minute fight.
Yes. Now, the Republicans, of course, are warning the Democrats that if they pass this, it's going to be the issue in every race in America this fall. Pro-health reform groups, of course, are gearing up to make a final push. But the White House is also trying to get industry to step in. The Business Roundtable, which is that group of major corporations who the president has been courting, issued a statement saying doing nothing will make the cost of providing health care to employees go up. And this is one of the most interesting things about this fight. To the extent that the health care effort is on life support, it got that way not because of opposition by industry, the way that Big Pharma or the insurance companies helped to kill the Clinton health care plan. Most of the industry groups have stayed inside the tent this time. This health care effort is in trouble because of grassroots opposition and a determined, disciplined minority on Capitol Hill, and the failure of the president's own Democrats to pass this bill when they should have, which was last year.
And Mara, on a related subject, it appears that one of the Democratic leaders on health care, the powerful chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, is in jeopardy of losing that post. Tell us about that.
Well, Chairman Rangel, Charlie Rangel of New York, has been found guilty by the Ethics Committee of an ethical violation. Republicans are planning to bring a resolution to the House floor calling for his removal as chairman. And what's the news is that Democrats are finally joining them. At least a dozen Democrats have said that Rangel should step down. The tide appears to be turning against the chairman, and his hold on the gavel looks as tenuous as ever. And it's very possible that he is going to have to step down from that powerful committee chairmanship.
And just briefly, any effect then on this whole larger debate about health care legislation?
Well, look, it's never good for the Democrats when they are accused of ethical abuses. Of course, the Republicans have trying to remind everyone that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi promised the most ethical House administration ever. And this can't help. But I don't think it has a direct effect on her ability to round up the votes she needs for health care, which is going to be pretty tough anyway.
NPR's Mara Liasson, thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
Let's turn now to people who are looking to leave their jobs and still retire comfortably. Problem is, investing for retirement can be complicated. There's lots of jargon, lots of investment choices, and lots of worry about whether those investments are too risky. What if you could replace all of that with one simple act, picking the year you expect to retire? That's what something called target date funds promise. As part of our series on retirement investing after the crash, NPR's John Itzde has that story.
Target date funds, sometimes called life cycle funds, are gaining in popularity. About 70% of all employer-sponsored 401k plans offer them, but so far only about 7% of all 401k assets are held in target date funds. The great advantage of the fund, says Alicia Munell of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, is that they automatically move people from stocks into safer investments like bonds as they get nearer to their retirement date.
Left on their own, they ended up with 65% of their assets in stocks in their 50s. These funds would get them down to 30 to 40% automatically.
The federal government has decided target date funds are a good option for retirement savings, too. It has given companies permission to automatically enroll new employees in the funds if they don't make a choice on their own.
Target date portfolios are a very, very good fundamental idea.
That's John Bogle, who founded the mutual fund giant Vanguard.
You've got some stocks and you've got some bonds, and you add to your bonds as you get older. The problem is they're also darn different.
Investors in target date funds with a retirement date of 2010 found out just how different they can be during the recent stock market collapse. Some lost as little as 10%, even though the stock market gave up about half its value. But others lost four times that much, says Mike Alfred of Brightscope, a 401k retirement plan rating service.
There were investors in 2010 target date funds that lost over 40%. And I don't think they expected, given that they were only a few years from retirement and were in a fund that was supposedly supposed to automatically adjust, they didn't expect to lose that much money.
The problem, says Alfred, is that the mix of investments in different funds varies widely, even ones targeted for the same retirement date. And it became clear after the market plunged that some target date funds designed for a 2010 retirement date held way too much stock. The lack of clarity about the risks involved in different funds has gotten the attention of Congress. Senator Herb Kohl, chairman of the Senate Special Committee on Aging, says, quote, "There's no question we need greater regulation and transparency of these products." Another big issue is the cost of these funds, says Mike Alfred.
The research we did for the Senate Aging Committee at the end of last year shows very clearly that these funds are 15% to 20% more expensive than the other funds and the core menus offered to American workers.
That is the core menu of investment options in the retirement plans offered by employers. The mutual fund rating service Morningstar says over half of target date funds have an annual management fee of 1% or more. That doesn't sound like much, but every 1 percentage point in fees can reduce your total accumulation by up to 20% by the time you retire. There are target date funds, though, with fees as low as about 0.2%. Vanguard's John Bogle says some funds are expensive because they double charge. There's one management fee for the funds assembled into the target date fund. Then there's another fee for the target date fund itself.
So there are a lot of red flags flying around target date funds, even as the fundamental idea of structure and increasing fixed income exposure as you age is the right idea.
So, says Bogle, investigate before you invest in a target date fund. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
And tomorrow, the big problem with American retirement savings, people aren't saving enough. The earthquake that rocked Chile last week was so big at an 8.8 magnitude that it may have caused a chunk of the Earth's crust to shift westward by at least 6 feet, which led to an even more startling result. Scientists at NASA calculate that the shift changed how the Earth moves on its axis and actually shortened the length of the day. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
You might think of the Earth as a perfectly spinning top, but that's not quite true. Richard O'Connell at Harvard University says the Earth actually wobbles a bit as it spins.
The consequence of that is that the rotation pole actually moves, and it moves around over an area about the size of a tennis court.
This is called the Chandler wobble. And back in the mid-1970s, O'Connell wrote a paper that showed how big earthquakes keep kicking the Earth, and by so doing, keep the Earth wobbling. Now we know that's not quite the whole story behind the wobble.
Subsequent work by other people showed that the atmospheric excitation is also very significant and also changes in ocean currents.
So sloshing oceans and the large-scale movement of air masses like typhoons can also shift mass around on the Earth enough to change the way it wobbles. All this shifting around can also change the speed at which the Earth spins, and that, of course, affects the length of a day. So along comes this week's earthquake, and folks at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory quickly calculated how much the Earth's rotation should have changed. Their answer? A day on Earth should have gotten shorter by a millionth of a second, and the Earth's wobbly axis should have shifted by about 3 inches within that tennis court-sized area where it tends to wander. But did it? Brian Luzum's job at the U.S. Naval Observatory is to keep tabs on the Earth's rotation and orientation. And he says even the best instruments in the world can't measure a change in day length as small as a millionth of a second. It is possible to measure the Earth's wobble pretty precisely, but considering how many things affect the Earth's wobble, it's hard to see the effect of the quake as well.
So on a day-to-day basis, we actually will see changes on the order of 2 or 3 inches happening every day. And to try to pick out this one particular signal in and among all the other signals just not really feasible.
The one hope was that the quake changed the wobble so abruptly that would show up in the data, Lusum said.
That's what you would like to be able to see to give you that eureka moment. And, of course, when we do look at the data, no such jump exists.
Theory says it happened, but the observations thus far aren't good enough to back that up. But if these planetary effects are trivial on a day-to-day basis, they can really add up over geological time. Adam Maloof at Princeton University notes that ice has been melting over the past 12,000 years as we come out of the last ice age, and that's changing the Earth's orientation by about an inch each and every year.
You can imagine that as the ice melts, you're redistributing the mass on the surface of the Earth. So all this water that was, you know, caught up in the ice at the poles is melting and moving into the oceans at lower latitudes.
And if you go way back in time to a period 800 million years ago, this kind of movement was dramatic. Over the course of a few million years, the landmass at the North Pole shifted monumentally, sliding south by 50 degrees.
That's basically taking New York to the equator, or even better, you're taking Paris to the equator.
Nobody knows why this happened, although Maloof says one idea is that a huge volcanic plume, like the one that created the Hawaiian Islands, developed near one of the poles, and that lopsided mass forced the Earth to rotate.
And would have had major ramifications for sea level, climate, landscape equilibrium, all sorts of effects like this.
And as for a single day's event, like the Chilean quake, well, it's fair to say that event touched hearts around the world, more tangibly than it changed the spin of our planet. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And now more fallout from the economic downturn. States facing record high deficits are making deep cuts in spending on safety net programs. That has children's advocates worried about efforts to prevent kids from being abused and neglected. As in other states, Oklahoma is finding such programs getting squeezed, just as people on the front lines of child abuse say the demand is growing. NPR's Pam Fessler went to Tulsa for this part of our series.
The women barely fit into the tiny chairs in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church in Tulsa, the rooms usually used for Sunday school. But these women are looking for a different kind of salvation.
There's sometimes, you know, I'll go back in the bedroom and I'll get my pillow and Red is in there watching cartoons and I'll go, and just scream in my pillow, you know?
Lori Mormon is one of several mothers who meet here twice a month. She has a 4-year-old daughter and a husband who's often away for work. She says even the best mothers sometimes feel like they're about to go crazy, especially if they have other stresses in their lives, which these women do, plenty of them.
I'm sure you guys have heard the most recent crazy, bizarre thing. He basically laid his hands on me and I had to put him in jail.
Susan Pham is talking about the father of her two young boys, how he physically abused her.
Put a protection order against him and everything.
And then there are the bills to juggle. Health insurance, the rent, daycare, if they're lucky enough to find work. But here, these women get to let it all out and to exchange advice mom to mom with the help of a family support worker. Mormon says these are friends she can rely on.
Just having this here, you know, it just helps. It's just to know you're not the only one here struggling. Mm-hmm. And just trying to make it day to day. No, my hormones off today.
The sessions are run by the Parent-Child Center of Tulsa, but funded by the state's Office of Child Abuse Prevention. Research shows that parenting groups like these can limit abuse by helping at-risk mothers, those with low incomes, histories of substance abuse, or other challenges. But the funding's been cut and will likely be cut again because the state of Oklahoma is $1.3 billion in the hole. Lawmakers say they want to protect children, but there are lots of demands. Still, children's advocates have some important allies.
If you really want to seriously deal with the issue of fighting crime, you invest in the types of programs that are going to give at-risk kids a healthy start.
Bill City is Oklahoma's chief of police. He says this is the kind of thing that pays off in the long run. Children who have been abused are more likely to become violent criminals when they grow up, so police chiefs and sheriffs across the country are pushing to fund efforts to prevent abuse and neglect, even though it might compete with their own short-term interests.
We need additional police officers, but it's a balance.
City says he can put criminals in jail all day long, but it won't get at the root of the problem. And his officers see it firsthand. They're often the first to respond to reports of abuse. And there's plenty of it here in a state where teen pregnancy and drug abuse are serious concerns.
Are you leaving? We have a child with a bruise on his face at a daycare, so Christy and I have to go.
That's Detective John Steggy of the Norman Police Department. He and another officer work at the Mary Abbott House, a cozy Victorian house in Norman. This is where the county's abuse and neglect cases are investigated. Police, welfare workers, and other specialists work side by side. The idea is to provide a non-threatening place where young victims can be interviewed once, not again and again by multiple agencies. Like everyone on the front lines I spoke to for this story, Executive Director Ann Way says caseloads are growing, even though funding is down.
Last week, we had interviews scheduled for about 21 children, which is probably the largest week that we've ever had. The stairs are steep and narrow, so be careful.
Outgoing Director Janine Baker takes me upstairs to see one of the interview rooms. Children come up from a downstairs waiting room filled with toys and stuffed animals, but here the room's bare with a big two-way mirror on the wall. Baker says alleged victims are told there's a police officer and a welfare worker on the other side listening in.
They watch TV. They know there's people behind the mirror. We're very open about that. Some of these kids have been betrayed by every adult they know, so we're not going to lie to them.
In the center of the room sits a small table with a large sketch pad. Children who've been physically or sexually abused can use it to help describe what happened. Sometimes they use cloth dolls. Baker removes a couple of them from a brown box by the wall.
This is probably a child.
She says the dolls come in every shape and race, boys, girls, men, women. There's even a grandpa doll.
So he's got grandpa hair on his chest and grandpa hair on his head. And
she opens the doll's pants.
Parts.
All the dolls are anatomically correct. This is serious business. Baker says most of the children who come here are the victims of sexual abuse. She thinks caseloads are up because people are more willing these days to report such abuse. But Mary Abbott House has also seen a rise in physical abuse cases with the economic downturn. Welfare worker Carla Holmes says she sees the pressures daily.
A lot of our parents are losing jobs. They're living in poverty. You know, there's a lot of substance abuse around here.
There also used to be two welfare workers at Mary Abbott House. Now there's only one. Two interview jobs have been cut to 1.5. And last month, it was a big shock when workers here tried to find emergency mental health services for a severely traumatized child. They called the place down the road that they usually used, only to find that it no longer cares for young children because of budget cuts. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
You can find Pam's first report, which profiles some tragic cases of deaths due to child abuse, at npr.org.